Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, we are the, well, we always have been, and we still are, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies, along with our fellow podcast, Deterrence Down Under, where you get a perspective from our Australian colleagues. And then we've got Real Space Strategies with Chris Stone, if you're interested in that kind of thing, which, of course, everybody should be. And of course, this week, yeah, Jim, welcome back.
I like space. Curtis.
Yeah. It's, it's a great place. I don't know about you, but I've got a friend that spends most of his time in space, one Mr. James T. Kirk. His dad's a great guy, too. He was also in the business.
But, you do know he's not real.
Right. Next thing you know, you're going to tell me that my hero that I've modeled most of my life on, of course, I'm talking about one Mr. Forrest Gump. You're going to tell me he's not real either. Yeah, well, it's craziness.
Well, crazy. Adam, I'll tell you, you caught me at my friend, and then you said James T. Kirk. So your pretend friend, James T. Kirk. I get it.
Is he riding your magical unicorn that you bring in, your pretend friends?
Well, if you can't have imaginary friends, what's this world come to?
That's right.
So today we were going to talk about minimum deterrence. There was an article that came out recently, last week, I think, in the National Interest, written by Ivan Elin. U.S. nuclear defense should not be so costly. And essentially, surprise, surprise, he says we need to get rid of the ICBM leg, get rid of Sentinel, cancel that program, and we should just have a Monad. Of course, this is, now he's at the Independent Institute, which, I often am a big fan of them. They're kind of a libertarian think tank. But one thing I've noticed is a lot of libertarians, Cato Institute, Independent Institute, I'm a graduate of all the programs at the Mises Institute, that they tend to be anti-nuke or just minimum deterrence, they're probably mostly minimum deterrence, but they have a lot in common with the disarmament and arms control community because they argue that nuclear deterrence is just too expensive and therefore a Monad will surely do it. And of course we disagree. One of the things that I don't know about what you think, Curtis, or you think, Jim, but I've noticed in both the arms control and disarmament and sort of the libertarian community, you have very few people who have sort of operational experience and actually understand why you do what you do.
It's why you need practitioners, Adam, to think these things through, right?
Yeah, if only there was a think tank that was just chock full of practitioners.
Yeah, imagine that. Thank you for the shameless plug.
Yeah, so I mean, his article, he makes sort of the same mistakes that a lot of folks make in mischaracterization. For example, he says, well, we have the United States currently has about 5,748 warheads in its nuclear arsenal, compared to Russia's only 5,580. So we have more than the Russians. But that's, of course, absolutely not true in any contextual way. And those are the kinds of mistakes that, Ivan makes. And, I reached out to him and I said, hey, I read your article. There were some sort of factual errors with it. And of course, I would welcome him on the show if he, hears about the podcast and wants to come on and, challenge us. That'd be great. Please do. But there's, so the idea that we have, 5,700 you know, weapons. Jim, this in many respects, this is kind of thrown over to you. It's a technical question because we want to distinguish between operationally deployed strategic nuclear weapons and the rest of what we have, which is not in any way in a position to where we can just throw it on an ICBM and it's usable. So can you maybe, you know, that's one myth I want to dispel is the false numbers.
Yeah, well, the numbers game, I mean, matters. And, you know, some of our adversaries, numbers mean a lot. But when we make treaties, we talk about operationally deployed because from a deterrence standpoint, they are operationally ready to be employed. And, you know, we use them every day. Okay, they're used in many, many ways as deterrent. But operationally deployed means that they are ready to go. And there are a lot of steps to get them operationally deployed to include matching a weapon with a delivery system, with an operation, with a targeting strategy, with a needed targeting strategy, with the effort there. Whereas weapons that are not operationally deployed are pretty much not in use, especially when you talk about first strike or second strike, because they are now not available. And the ability to make them available, you know, to do all those things, match them against a delivery vehicle, match them against the command and control system, match them against a target. Those are all needed for all of our nuclear weapons because they are strategic weapons.
But it's not, it's more than that. I mean, when they're in storage, they're missing components.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's what I said. I just, there's stuff that's not available to match them because our weapons are, I mean, the design of our weapons and design of our weapon systems are such that they can be matched with different weapon systems. And remember, some of these systems have been around for 20, 30 years, the delivery aircraft, the delivery systems, the communication systems that interact with that delivery system. All must be designed to connect to it and make it function the way it's supposed to. And those systems have been upgraded, changed, et cetera. And so the weapons have to be able to be interact with the delivery system. The second piece that most people forget, and especially the non-proliferation folks, we hear about this, I think we talked about it a couple of podcasts ago, where people say, oh, the president can get up and hit a button and all these weapons go flying all over the place. Okay. There are many, many steps to employ those weapons, and all those steps require something to interact with. It's not like a hand grenade, or even a hand grenade, you pull a pin. But you know, it's not like sitting there ready to go that gets launched out and thrown. So they have to be assembled, and depending on their level of assembly and their level of management, all those things have to take place. And remember, this takes people. This is I think the one overlooked thing, especially in these articles. I'm going to jump ahead. It takes people to make those things function. It costs time and effort and training and value that we would expect as Americans with our weapons. We don't just hand out nuclear weapons. I was listening to a comedian. So since Adam brought up comedians, I can't remember. He talked, and it's an old comedian who talked about the United States needs ICBMWs. ICBM Winnebagos, where we just take a Polaris missile, stick it on top of a Winnebago, and send it out with someone every night, and that would scare the heck out of our adversaries. Okay, it's sort of a silliness, but my point is, our systems are not like that. We don't just let anyone have them, let anyone control them, and let them loose so that they can be fired at any moment. There's a lot to be done aside from those operationally, even with the operationally deployed weapons. They still have a lot of steps to get them in, you know, to make them launch that must occur in order to have controls. So we have safety and security, better known as surety, by the way. Did that help out, Adam?
I guess the thing that I was looking for was, you know, according to New START, which we still support, you know, we have 1,550 operationally deployed nuclear weapons on 700 delivery vehicles. And the ones that are in storage are in, you know, they're missing components that we would have to put back in them to then get them. And of course, there'd be a lot of maintenance, and then we'd have to get them ready. And then we'd have to go through the whole multi-year process of, you know, if we wanted to put three, RVs on a Minuteman III, that would take years to do. So the idea that we have 5,800 warheads, it's a almost useless number, because most of them, we just can't use them. And if we go to war, they're not going to be ready for that war.
Yeah.
And so it's not a useful number.
I just would caution Adam in saying it would take some time, and we'll just leave it at that. I'm not sure years is right, but there are time periods for various weapons in the system. That's all. But the point is valid. Your point is valid, as I stated, and the point is valid in that they are not ready, and therefore they are not useful as a deterrent against an adversary, especially in a first strike, which is what we have to worry about first. And even in a second strike capability, probably not.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things he makes. Curtis, you had some other stuff that he said that, you had took issue with. So I'll let you take your turn on this one.
Well, let me say this. Thanks, Adam. I think this is one of these articles that really bothers me in a number of different ways. Dr. Elon takes the time to write this article under his byline with his organization in his biography. And I wouldn't have accepted this data from my graduate students. The numbers here are just so off that this is an article he might have been correct 3 years ago. Even SIPRI, right, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, right, a Swedish organization, anti-nuke. Their January report of the world's nuclear warheads are that, yes, Russia has 5580. He was correct there. But America is 5,044. And I would say going down. And this assumption that every warhead is deployable, in the way that he presents this, you can have all kinds of, of warheads, but if they're not if they don't have an ability to be force postured, to be quote unquote deployed on a delivery system, they're not really much good, in that sense. And so what I get the sense out of here is that there's an effort here to, again, confuse the American reader or the reader and with facts that are so far off that they're not facts anymore. The gentleman even refers to in his chief complaint is, and you read his title, but the next line to that title is, instead of investing billions in outdated missile defense systems, why not move to a minimum deterrent doctrine? And so his point here is that he's complaining about the costs, and he used this recycled $1.7 trillion program that was made up by the Federation of American Scientists and has been recycled all around. And I can't find any proof as to where that number comes from. My calculus, using government numbers, including accounting for Nunn McCurdy, at best, it's still $1.3 trillion.
This is part of the disinformation. Yeah. Is that look at the actual cost, it's been in the $600 billion range for the modernization. You've got another $600 to $800 billion for daily operation and maintenance of both the existing systems now and future systems, out 30 or 40 years. So what we're actually looking at, so the 1.7 trillion really equates to 50 to 60 billion per year, which is 5 to 7% of the defense budget. So in 1962, a majority of the defense budget, 55% of the total defense budget, went to Strategic Air Command. At the height of modernization, we're going to spend 7%.
Right. Right. Well, and again, in his article, he notes that the public debt is $26 trillion. Now, Adam, I don't know about you, but on November 2nd, when he published this article, I wish the public debt was at $26 trillion. It's at 36 and counting. So if you're going to make an argument, we need to make sure that our facts are correct. And you're absolutely spot on, Adam, with that assessment that of that $1.3 trillion, about 40% of it is sunk costs that you would be paying anyway to maintain the current system, right? As it ages, you know, maintenance and all the things that need to be done as it ages. So no one is. So I guess if you're saying let's eliminate, you know, $1.whatever trillion, you're kind of saying I want to get rid of it all at once. Now you know me, Adam. I'm one of these believers of anybody who claims to be a minimalist is really a unilateral disarmer that knows they can't get there. So they argue for minimalism. And in this case, our good friend here, Dr. Elon says, sort of arbitrarily says, hey, we need to just go down to a monad. You know, these missiles are too vulnerable. And the bombers are again, too vulnerable. And he says, we really just need to just pay for the submarines, the Columbia class submarines. And, which he says are $130 billion. That's actually an accurate number. And that we should go to a monad. And he says, this will be labeled as unilateral disarmament. But it's really just eliminating costly and wasteful massive overkill. Well, first of all, it is unilateral disarmament because the adversaries aren't going to follow along. Okay. And so it is what you think that it's not. It actually is. And it doesn't eliminate massive overkill. There is a reason why we need so many warheads. And here's my point. He proffers in his piece here that if there are 500 major targets in Russia and China and it takes two warheads to destroy each target, then all we need is 1,000 warheads. And, you know, to his credit, I did the math. You can fit 1,000 warheads on 12 Columbia-class submarines. But here's the thing, Adam. They're not all deployed at the same time.
That's right.
So you're already going to cut that number down to somewhere between a third and half. Okay. And where are the rest of those boats? Sitting in port, as vulnerable as the other things he complains about. So again, I don't know that the good doctor thinks through his argument when we're trying to posit what deterrence is. He doesn't necessarily dismiss deterrence to his credit. And so if you believe in some measure of deterrence, you have to understand that we don't get to decide what deters Russia or China. They get to decide what deters them. We have to be able to project enough force so that they are willing to perceive the fear of retaliation and destruction that is intolerable enough that therefore, yet not today. You have to be able to sort of put that on. Deterrence doesn't just occur because you have a capability. It just doesn't. If it did, then all locked doors would prevent burglaries, but they don't.
So I will say he and I talked via email, and one thing he did say was that he does believe in deterrence. Nobody does believe that a minimum deterrent is sufficient. And then he also made the argument that there was an article by Barry Blechman and I forget who else, maybe Krasner, that where they say, hey, listen, you know, more nuclear weapons leads to American intervention. And so a larger nuclear arsenal leads to more American intervention around the world. You know, you feel more free. And he says, you know, hey, the data's there that we'll go and intervene in, you know, Somalia and Serbia, and you pick a place because we have this arsenal and therefore we feel freer to go do that kind of stuff. Now, the argument, I don't buy it because I think, you know, Matt Cronin makes a different argument, and I don't see, you know, you can show causation without or correlation without causation. And this is where I think, you know, there's probably some corollary, but it's a corollary for a different reason. But I'd have to go look at the data to see what they say. But that's what he says. So it's
I hear you.
We have to
I'm actually believer in what that is. So that's the stability instability paradox, which says that if you've got a nuclear capability behind you, then you're freer to sort of maneuver with that protection. We see China doing that. America has been doing that forever and ever. We hide under the cloak of American exceptionalism, but the reality is that our nuclear power enables all of the other things that we want to do. There's no doubt about that. So if you want to eliminate the nuclear deterrent, or at least shrink it to the point where it is, much less useful in that sense, then you're essentially advocating that you want to do less in the world. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but that's not the case, because what happens then is, at least the mentality right now of the minimalists, not the libertarians, but the interventionist minimalists, are that we'll just spend a lot more money building much more conventional capability, and we will deter that way. The problem is when you have a huge conventional force to replace it, it's not only way more expensive, requires a lot more people, which we can't recruit as it is, but it becomes so provocative in its size that you will draw the necessary reaction in the world. And so when we talk about arms racing and the action-reaction dynamic, what we tend to ignore is the understanding is that when other nations nuke up, they are actually reacting to our conventional buildup, because that is the only way they can parry it in some manner, because they can't, sort of match that force on force due to the prowess. And I would add, not only are because we're so good at conventional warfare, we also have a lot of credibility of using that force on a regular basis. And that's what bothers people in the world. And there's where I think I might actually find some commonality with Dr. Eland. But I think the reality here is that there are different ways of getting where you need to be. I think if you want to save money, the good doctor ought to be looking at what spends the other 90% of the DoD budget. It isn't by cutting nukes. It's about cutting maybe some of the other things, right? And those are the things that actually cause war and kill people. I like to remind our listeners, since 1945, Jim, how many human beings have been killed in anger by a nuclear weapon?
I'm putting a big zero up here.
Zero.
Zero. Okay. Okay, but well, Curtis, I want to add one other thing. So it's about method, So I always like to go back and say, what's the mission? The mission is to preserve peace and prosperity. And from a national standpoint, we want to preserve our national security interests. And when we start talking about minimum deterrence, it's like saying, well, I'd like to stop my car. I'd like you to put on the minimum brake to get me just to stop before I hit something and hope nothing changes. And then it changes. And then you're playing catch up, which is where we are now. And that, to me, is the game that we've got to get out of, because it's more costly to take your car in after the accident, get it repaired, and then get the new brake system on, in the same fashion as we see here with the way in which we are using our nuclear deterrent. So although I will never disagree with you on the fact that nuclear, just like nuclear energy, nuclear weapons are in fact an efficient way of bringing the fear about in our adversary, the flip side to that is playing catch up is a very bad position and a very, very much more costly effort than maintenance and staying ahead. And we don't do that. Not saying it's a major part of our budget. I don't want our audience to hear that, but it's even worse. We make it worse by saying, let's just go minimally and see what happens. Because for nuclear weapons, the reason why, Genghis Khan didn't have nuclear weapons is because you have to have a large industrial base to start and build, and a scientific base to build them. And because we already have it, the investment's already there. It's done. So many parallels with nuclear reactors. Reactors are the same way. You support the nuclear reactors. You put all the investment in up front because the fuel cost is so incredibly small, and you make your money over a long time, which is what we've done. We're already, that piece there, except we left it deteriorate over time. We're just playing catch up.
You know, although I would dispute the idea that nuclear weapons and a larger nuclear arsenal is the reason for intervention. It's a corollary. It's not causal, because you can also point to the Eisenhower era, mm-hmm. where we very specifically had absolute nuclear advantage. We never had greater advantage in nuclear terms than we did during the Eisenhower administration.
That's a great point, Adam. Historically.
But it isn't.
Well, I mean, but you don't need nuclear weapons to, the problem is that the challenge is that nuclear weapons really aren't relevant for a lot of American intervention.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, look at where we go. We don't need to nuclear coerce anybody. And we don't need to have the nuclear available to push back the Russians or the Chinese, because they're not going to get involved anyways. So, it's the lack of understanding of, what's at play. This is the challenge with understanding American foreign policy. Foreign policy in general is the why and the rationale, and understanding how your adversary perceives your action, how it perceives potential threats. And we oftentimes attribute things that don't belong.
But Adam, wouldn't you say, though, I mean, I agree with you that the intervention is not a result of having nuclear weapons, but they can be. I mean, isn't that Putin's, number one way of having any, if he had to rely on his conventional forces only, he would definitely not be as quick to intervene in many ways. So they can be, they just aren't with U.S. policy, mm-hmm. which I think is great.
Well, let's say that Vladimir Putin had no nuclear weapons. Let's suppose he did. We're not going to threaten him with nuclear coercion.
So we
would not do that. So I don't see how nuclear weapons have the role that what they're good at is preventing nuclear powers from being attacked.
Right. No, you and I think are saying the same thing. It's just that the nuclear weapons aren't the cause. It's the policy of the country that matters. That's what matters the most, right? Regardless what you have, the weapons don't cause it. Go ahead, Curtis.
There's always a couple of exceptions to that idea. History says, Eisenhower made some threats to get the Korean War to end. We know that control, one of the main reasons why America was careful not to, to expand the Vietnam War was because of a nuclear arm to China. We know that the Russians levied a nuclear threat to get hostages back out of Lebanon. And we know that the U.S. used a veiled nuclear threat going into Gulf War I and in Desert Storm to prevent chemical attacks, or at least to try to deter chemical attacks, I should say. Mm-hmm. So there have been a few, but this is why they exist. Right, it's not something we do every day. Like they sit and deter every day, yes, but the ability to use some coercion in order to deter in an aggressive forward manner, like our adversaries have been doing to us here lately, or to the rest of the world, these things. That's why they exist. They are a tool for that sort of thing. But that is a version of foreign policy, and it is a tool that foreign policy cares about, And there's always a lot of interest in how these systems are positioned and readied. What is their sort of alert status when things start warming up around the world? You'd be surprised, I would think, that how many might be interested in what it is. And so I think the challenge here is that we cannot do it with fewer. The argument right now, even from the Biden administration, is that we may need more. And so, the good Dr. Elon, I think, is looking at a different direction. But I want to go one more as we're getting close to wrapping up here, in that if America pursues a minimalist policy, whether it's 1,000 warheads, as he stipulates in his article, or others where the numbers are even smaller, then what happens, as you know, Adam, you know, it forces America. You only have so many weapons to cover so many targets. So it kind of brings you back to that counter value strategy of targeting cities, holding cities at risk, which is really counter to America's ethics and morals, the law of armed conflict, and has actually been against American policy since the 1980s when Weinberger put his note out that said, we are not going to target Russian cities in the hopes that they will do the same. I mean, this is how this works, right? And so I think to turn around and drop, I think our adversaries would be very unhappy if we dropped to a minimalist stature, because they would then know that we would then be targeting their cities, and that would bother them to the point where they would ensure that we knew they were targeting ours. And so I think this is a challenge that we need to avoid. This is the one value to a counterforce strategy. While it does demand more weapons, it does convey to the adversary that it is not our intent to target innocent civilians as a whole. And so I think that's something that we have to consider when you have folks who are arguing for saving money, that there's some moral equivalence that if I have fewer weapons, that there's less people that will die. I'm not sure that's true.
I'd also like to, you know if these folks would support, let's say we knew there were three bad guys that were going to try to break into your house. And so you essentially said, okay, well, there's three bad guys, so I'm going to give you three bullets to shoot at the bad guys, because there's only three. So you obviously need three bad guys. Or maybe we'll follow the logic and we'll say, well, we'll give you two bullets per bad guy. And then right. that should be plenty.
So you got a revolver with six rounds and three yeah. dudes running at you.
And that should be plenty, because that gives you two bullets. So that's, right. I mean, it's a ludicrous thing to say. And how many times have we said on this podcast, Vietnam, 56,000 rounds for each NVA kill? In the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we spent 250,000 rounds of small arms fire for each adversary we killed. 250,000 rounds. But yet somehow we only need enough nuclear weapons, because every weapon is going to hit every target. Because right. that's right. just, I mean, surely because of all the previous nuclear wars we fought, that's been how they worked out. Or is it that we're just going to absolutely ignore all military history that has very clearly showed us that you need a lot more ammunition than you actually have targets?
So let me carry your analogy just one step further. Let's say that 6-round revolver you have is a .22 caliber versus a .38 caliber, right? And so you're firing your 6 rounds, and even if you hit each target twice, those small rounds aren't going to stop them. If you use bigger rounds, maybe that will stop them more. You've got to deal with and I think the misses will come as you've got a shaky hand, or you don't have time to draw aim, and these other types of things. And so that all comes into sort of the fog and friction of that moment. And so those things matter too. And so if you are not only limiting you to the number of shots you have, but also to the size of those shots and to the,
what if they start inability shooting at me
to
first?
Ensure it happens? Oh, and what if they shoot at me first and they've actually shot the gun out of my hand and I've got to pick it up? So, I mean, there's all kinds of different things that
it's just this idea of how we treat nuclear weapons somehow as if they're totally and completely like any other weapon of war.
Wait, let me get in on our big Second Amendment discussion here, because I'm enjoying it. But I think at one point, both of my favorite deterrence experts missed, and it's this. What if you were being aggressed by someone and you said, stop, I have two bullets in my pistol to shoot at you, and then I'm out?
So make sure you run at me in a straight line so I don't miss.
That's what deterrence is, though. Would someone stop knowing how many rounds you've got aimed at them? You want to bring the fear into them to not even come at you. And that's right. The point.
What I would do is I would start by letting them know that I mean them no harm. and that, you know, I wish them well, and therefore my goodwill will be plenty to prevent them from.
And I would send them each a harshly worded letter first.
Yes.
Well, yeah. If they're stopped by a harshly worded letter, I'm fine with that. Usually it doesn't work though. But anyway, so yeah.
To summarize, though, we don't like minimum deterrence, and we don't like inaccurate arguments that really don't get the facts right. And because, you know, actually knowing what you're talking about does matter. And so, therefore, being able to talk the finances, the operations, the strategy, how do you operationally target, all that stuff actually matters in nuclear weapons, as opposed to sort of making vague, you know, morally outraged arguments about, you know, we don't need them and they're too expensive. And in reality, none of that's true. I mean, I just want to know, when are these people who think nuclear weapons are too expensive going to start getting outraged at the fact that Medicare and Medicaid lose $90 billion every single year in waste, fraud, and abuse? And that, did you know that the federal government spends more money in Social Security payments to dead people every single year than we spend on the nuclear arsenal? Why is nobody outraged about that? But yet we can afford that. Paying dead people, eminently affordable. Waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid, eminently affordable. But somehow nuclear weapons can't be afforded? How? On what planet?
You want an answer to that? Stop. You want that, Adam? Or was that a rhetorical question?
Maybe it was
a rhetorical rant, I think.
Yeah. I just, the financial argument drives me insane because it's just false. It's so
absolutely.
False.
Absolutely.
But you know what? You know who's going to solve that problem? Come January the 20th, one Mr. Elon Musk.
Yeah.
There you go.
Elon's going to solve it.
Jim, what if the government kind of said, hey, maybe we should hire Elon Musk to build the next generation ICBM? He's really good at building rockets. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know, but what I would say is Elon Musk at least involved in this because he's a business person versus government, because we've allowed government to get in the way. Is if you reduce all of the government overhead, and we talked about this probably for another show, the amount of overhead we've placed on ourselves versus someone who's an entrepreneurial spirit and knows how to get things done and get done quickly is really the issue. And I'll bring up a good friend of mine that was on our podcast just some time ago, the good General Goodfellow, who asked a question at a conference one time, why the first time we built missiles took 4 years to get it on the ground, and now it's going to take 35 years. Like, what's different? You would think it the other way around. You think modern technology we put up here. So we're the only reason we're strangled, whether Elon Musk or Curtis McGiffin, you know, leading this effort, the only constraints we held are the constraints we put on ourselves. And it's the same thing with the minimal deterrence argument. We constrain ourselves in meeting our requirement. So why don't we start with the requirement base first? What do we need to do based upon what our adversary says and what deters them? And then let's make sure that we have sufficient capability to deter them so we remain at peace. So I'm not sure I answered your question about Elon, because Elon well. I'd love to invite him over for dinner and have a discussion. I'd love for him to donate to NIDS. I'd love him to do a lot of things. So Elon, if you're out there listening,
well, I would say,
give me a call.
I would say that if Elon were to build ICBMs, he has to leave out the part where the rockets actually come back and land. So that kind of doesn't work for us in the ICBM world.
You know, Elon doesn't build rockets that, first of all, his are all liquid fueled. And so he hadn't built a solid fueled one. So that'll be, and that's a big difference.
Yeah.
And then his, you know, our rockets have to sit in the silos for over 50 years.
Yeah, that's outrageous.
I don't think that he's ever built anything that was designed to last that long. He understands
building anything for 50 years is outrageous.
But wait a minute. I've been around for 62, and look at me.
At you. That's what I'm saying.
So, no, but what would really be nice is if we could actually get add and subtract missiles on like a yearly basis. So dynamic parity would be great.
There you
so
go.
So there we go.
That's a great plug.
And that's a plug for dynamic parity. We can add and subtract quickly. So another another requirement for Elon, right? All right.
Okay, here's it. So the last thing I want to say here, and I'll let you wrap it up, Adam, is that for the good Dr. Elon, who has every right to be concerned about the length of time to take to do this and the amount of money, both of which in my mind are outrageous. It is because we have overburdened, as you go to your point, Jim, we have overburdened ourselves with bureaucracy and other mechanisms that are slowing this process down. But most importantly, and I think Adam, you would agree with me, it is because the nation has really yet to make this a priority. There was one of the senior leaders described the amount of work going into the Sentinel system as being as big as, under Eisenhower, the design and construction of the interstate highway system.
Yeah.
75,000 miles of cable and copper that needs to be changed out and all these sorts of things. I mean, it is just unbelievable what has to be done in this synchronous relationship with industry and the Air Force and the Navy to get all these systems up and running, competing with other systems that have to be done with a limited number workforce, while high quality, there just aren't enough, and this inability to sort of close the loop in this defense industrial complex that we sort of let deteriorate after the Cold War. And so now, there's a national strategy to reinvigorate this thing, but we've already started ignoring it, in my opinion, because we still can't get around the corner on this. We should be hearing stories about how these things are moving to the left in the schedule. Everything has moved to the right by 3 years in the last year. And every time something moves to the right, it gets more expensive, and it is a greater burden on the legacy systems that need to fill the void, and it is more risk to America's safety, security, and in my mind's eye, the global peace and stability, which rely on America's nuclear deterrent to do that. We have to make this a national priority.
Okay. Well, I'm going to end it there because we're 12 minutes over. So we have we have to bring this show to an end. So thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. As you can see, we are passionate about why we don't like minimum deterrence. But so thanks for listening to the show. Of course, hit us up on the Twitter or the X and LinkedIn, and don't forget Global Security Review and everything else. We are here to keep you entertained and provide you things to either listen to or read. So thanks for joining us on this episode, and we will see you on the next one. Oh, and as always, remember to think deterrence.
Of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.